Next case is number 02-1295, Apotex Incorporated against the Secretary of Health and Human Services, the Food and Drug Administration, and SmithKline Beecham. Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I will start with the question that we started with before Judge Jackson quite some time ago. The question in this case is whether, and certainly if at some point in time, when there will ever be a generic competitor for SmithKline's new drug, that's the core question.
You're really asking us to decide, to give an advisory opinion? Can we, it would be helpful to concentrate on the issues that are here.
Yes, ma'am. First of all, the question is truly whether there will be a judicial remedy. This court has said in the Mylan case that an ANDA applicant has no claim against the NDA holder / patentee of illegally listed patents from the Orange. Now, that leaves us with whether there is an action against FDA. And we submit, for the many reasons we set forth in our brief, that has to be the case. But in the alternative, there is a more fundamental question here, and that is whether there is any gatekeeper anywhere federal government, be it the executive branch or the judiciary, to police the clear and unambiguous requirements of the statute regarding the listing of patents in the Orange Book. Statute 355C2, 355B1 is crystal clear. The NDA applicant or NDA holder shall file patents which claim for which the application was submitted. And FDA has refused to police this mandatory requirement of the statute. And now we are left with a separate question, whether there is a right to judicial review.
Now, isn't the question, as Judge Jackson found, that the remedy of the statute, which is the infringement suit, is the statutory remedy. You're saying that there is no remedy, but in such an action, the validity, infringement, and every other aspect of the patent is subject to challenge. Now, I appreciate that there is a question as to the adequacy of, or at least the expeditiousness of such a remedy, but where did Judge Jackson go wrong in stating that this was a legislative issue rather than a judicial one?
The APA Section 704 says there shall be a right of review for any final agency action for which there is no other remedy in a court. Now, the relief that we have sought here is relief requiring FDA to grant final approval of Apotex's abbreviated new drug application, or ANDA. Apotex has completed, the FDA has completed every subsequent aspect of this review of that application, and the only thing holding up, final approval are these additional patents listed in the Orange Book on which the filed actions and on which SmithKline has obtained multiple 30-month stays.
Well, Mr. Moore, I think we all understand the factual background. I take it, though, that your answer to Judge Newman about the adequacy of the subsequent litigation that the statute provides for would be that the subsequent litigation doesn't deal with problem of the temporary injunction that's ordered by statute, the automatic 30-month temporary injunction, and that given the decision of this court in Andrax, there's no way to shorten that except in the narrow current circumstances that Andrax says it can be shortened within the context of the subsequent litigation. But in terms of the repetitiousness of filing of perhaps improper patents, your argument is, if I understand it, that the listing creates this temporary injunction for which there is no judicial remedy. Is that, do I understand your brief correctly?
Precisely so. These cases should never have been filed under the statutory patent infringement mechanism established by Hatch-Waxman.
But look at the implications of your argument, Mr. Moore. The implications of your argument would appear to be that the FDA would have to set up a system of some kind involving, and I suppose this would not come as a terrible blow to the patent lawyers in the country, a system of some kind equipped with proper patent lawyers and analysts to determine whether a particular patent that the patentee proposes to list in the Orange meets the criteria of the statute. And then the subsequent result would be that you'd be right back up here challenging the decision of the FDA under an APA theory, and we'd have just another set of litigation before we ever got to the patent suit. Am I missing something? Is that not the implication of your position?
No, Your Honor. With all due respect, I will say that we regard one remedy here, one easy remedy, as FDA hiring a patent lawyer or two.
Or 10 or 12 or 20, whatever it may take.
Well, in our appendix, it is interesting, Your Honor, in our appendix, at one point early on in the case of the district court, we undertook a little survey to see how many patents were actually listed in the Orange Book in a year, and the number was under 40. I was surprised, and I think everyone else was surprised. So we are not looking at a massive administrative task.
Well, even assuming you're not looking at a massive administrative task, are we looking at yet another basis for more litigation now over the listing question before we even get to the hypothetical infringement suit that Hatch-Waxman creates for us?
I have two responses. First of all, I think it is likely that if there were an administrative enforcement scheme in place, we would not see the sorts of patents that we see in this case. It's a self-generating system. You go to the patent to get any kind of a patent that you can. You get it into the Orange Book. You provoke the paragraph 4 certification, the resulting lawsuit, and you've got your automatic 30-month stay. And district courts are busy, very busy. And even if it's a clear case of non-infringement or invalidity, it can take a long time get a decision, get the patent issues resolved, and in the meantime, the innovator company has continued with its monopoly.
Why is this different from what you've asked now? You took this case to the district court. You've asked that court to construe the claims, which we know generally embraces all of the major issues in patent litigation, involves the prosecution history and prior art and all sorts of things. So, and here we are, although we're here reviewing the threshold question, had the district court actually undertaken the review that you say is appropriate with respect to the listing, wouldn't you have as elaborate a litigation and a direct appeal from the FDA rather than an appeal under Hatch-Waxman?
Your Honor, first of all, I am and willing for the purpose of this case to accept the premise that claim construction will frequently be a difficult process. It most assuredly is not in this case.
Well, if it's not difficult, then it should go expeditiously under Hatch-Waxman as well. After all, that, those 30 months are a maximum, and any delays in the dockets of the district courts and the appellate courts would apply just as well, whether it comes through Hatch-Waxman, would it not, or whether it's an administrative appeal, plus undoubtedly having an extra tribunal in the administrative agency.
Your Honor, I think it's necessary to make one clear distinction between underlying patent litigation that's currently ongoing and the case that we brought to the district court and that we brought here. The issue in the underlying patent infringement litigation is whether the relevant claim or claims of the patent in the suit read on the accused product. What is not at issue in the underlying patent litigation is whether the claim or claims of the relevant patent read on the innovator's product, the NDA holder's product. That is a question that is never addressed in the underlying Hatch-Waxman litigation. So, in the patent litigation, the district court never gets to that issue. Now, could the district court have gotten there if this court had answered, had ruled the other way in my land? Yes. My land blocks us from pursuing that relief in the patent court, quote
unquote. Wait a minute. My land blocks you because you're saying that is not a litigable issue under my land as between the private parties.
Precisely. This court held in my land quite clearly that there is no right of action under either the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act or the patent statutes to force the delisting of an illegally listed patent.
But by the time you get to that litigation, isn't the question of listing sort of historical? I mean, who cares at that point?
Well, I will tell you in answer to that, we care a great deal for two reasons. First of all, the multiple 30-month stays that can go on ad infinitum if an NDA holder patentee is able to control the prosecution of applications through the patent office at an appropriate pace, then this can go on forever. Patents issue yearly. They get listed in the Orange Book yearly.
You know, I thought might have thought that was a problem, but you tell us there are only 40 patents listed for the entire massive pharmaceutical industry in this nation?
That was the interesting thing about this.
It is interesting.
That was an interesting and surprising finding for us.
Perhaps it's not an issue.
Is this abuse widespread? I don't know. I'm in two or three cases where, in our view, there is abuse. And one case like this is one too many. We're dealing with a $2 billion market. Fine, has continued to file patent applications. We counted them all up at the time we filed our reply brief. And here I see on January 2, 2003, U.S. Patent Application 2003-0004188, invented is peroxidine hydrochloride anhydride in 4B and N-peroxidine hydrochloride in 4D.
Are you asking us to presume that there's something fraudulent about that activity? I'm not sure I understand the issue.
Your Honor, I am not asking the court to presume fraud. I am absolutely not doing this. However, I can tell you that it's a matter of public record that the Federal Trade Commission is investigating Smith-Kline for potential violation of the antitrust laws in connection with this patent listing.
Well, then perhaps your issues will be resolved in that forum.
Perhaps it would, but the congressional purpose of this statute is twofold. One, to protect legitimate intellectual property rights of NDA holders, and second, to encourage the introduction of generic competition. The scheme, the The scheme as it currently exists today, in our case, certainly, and in another case involving a drug by the name of gabapentin, in an appeal which this court just decided about two weeks ago.
Is that before us in this case?
No, Your Honor, it is not.
Okay. All right, thank you, Mr. Morgan.
I see I'm into my reply time.
You've exceeded your time, but Judge Bryson has
Could I ask a question? Because jurisdiction has been raised, and I didn't want to chew into your argument on the merits. But it's an important question, and I would like you to comment on it. And in particular, I would like you to comment on whether, given the exclusive jurisdiction that this court has over cases that arise in part under 1338, which would be the premise for our having jurisdiction in this case at all, whether that would mean that in cases such as the AAI Pharma case, which went to the Fourth Circuit, and some of the Hatch-Waxman cases that have been decided by the D.C. Circuit, those courts would not have jurisdiction, and we would have exclusive jurisdiction over this kind of appeal and the kind of appeal that was taken in AAI Pharma.
I think there are two answers to that question, and I have thought about this a good bit. The first answer is 355B1 and C2. I see that. Clearly represent statutes relating to patent law under 1338. And this court ought to be dealing with, to the extent we do, ought to be dealing with this, with these listing issues. The question of whether a given patent claims a drug is quintessentially an issue of patent law. And this is the very threshold point in this statutory scheme. And my second answer is, we are here asking for judicial relief in the form of final approval of Apotex's ANDA. An essential element of our right to recover is establishing that the patents in question do not claim the approved drug. And only that determination, that claim construction determination, gets the job done. It is an essential element of our right to relief under Christensen versus Cole and this court's authority.
And would you, well, if I could just, the second half of my question was, would the Fourth Circuit be incorrect in having assumed jurisdiction in that case?
Yes.
Yes, and the D.C. Circuit, ditto?
Yes.
Yeah, so we'd be going into conflict with both of those circuits on the jurisdictional issue to the extent that they can be deemed to have addressed and ruled on the jurisdictional question.
The D.C. Circuit, I do not believe, there's plenty of case law out there, the D.C. Circuit, I do not believe, ever ruled on a case like this.
Okay.
The circuit sits out there by itself.
But the D.C. Circuit rulings on Hatch-Waxman issues, you say, would be, the D.C. Circuit would be deprived of jurisdiction over the kinds of cases they have addressed?
No, Your Honor.
No.
I
thought you said
not.
The answer was yes. Okay.
My focus here, I haven't tried to draw a line.
That's part of the challenge here, isn't it?
Yes, it is. My focus here is 355B1 and C2.
Right.
Now, when we turn to questions of exclusivity, when we turn to a question of whether under Hatch-Waxman there is, as we have argued, only one 30-month stay available,
okay. All right.
Those questions answer the patent law question. Clearly belong in the D.C. Circuit. They are here before this court only as a matter of appended jurisdiction. Quite clearly, the majority of the issues that arise under this statute belong belong in the D.C. Circuit or another regional circuit.
So you're saying that the patent laws referred to in this in 1338 for present purposes include not all of Hatch-Waxman, but only 355 B1 and C2?
I think that's clearly correct.
And there's nothing else in Hatch-Waxman that you think would fall within the patent laws requirement? Provision
of 1338. Well, there is this court's own precedent in at least two cases involving patent term extension, where the court went about the exercise of construing provisions of Hatch-Waxman and Uri Gateway Rounds Agreement Act in order to correlate those two people separately.
But those would have been in the context of a private suit for patent infringement, wouldn't they not?
No, these were, and I hope I have the procedural posture right, I have it right on at least one. One of them was clearly a suit against FDA and the head of the patent office. That goes back to about 1989.
Oh.
The case is cited and discussed in our brief.
Okay, what?
These cases are cited. Discussed our briefs, if you
well, that's all right. I'll find it. All right.
Let me follow up a little bit on this because we need jurisdiction. Of course, we have to attend to, even if you didn't, but you did. Let me. Your suggestion in your colloquy with Judge Bryson is that a question like the sequential 30-month temporary injunction issue could go to, say, the D.C. Circuit as a purely APA issue if there were no patent issue raised in that same suit. But I think that you would say that we could decide the question here, since it's been raised in this case, because it is either, well, perhaps because it is pendant. It's a pendant issue to the patent issue that you're alleging is raised by your view of Hatch-Waxman. Is that right?
That's right. I think it's...
Now, add to that. Okay. So, basically, all right. Now, I assume that if we disagreed with your view of whether your reading of those statutory sections raise a patent issue. I suppose if you had also a count in your claim, in your original complaint, that was a clear patent case issue, we would have jurisdiction over the whole mess. And in that regard, you mentioned several times in your brief that no matter what else happens, count four. Complaint does the job of jurisdiction. Can you help me? I've read and reread count four, and I'm trying to understand exactly why you singled count four out as getting you in the door regardless of what we thought about any other part of your issues.
I went back over the amended complaint, Your Honor, and I will give you, first of all, first paragraph of count four incorporates by reference all previous allegations.
All 187. Yes, I went back and reread them all since we were close.
Paragraph 3. Paragraph 83. 132 patent claims to different drug.
What page of the joint appendix are you reading from, if you could help us?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor. This is the allegations in question are at A02704.
Right.
Paragraphs 3, 83, 105, 118, and 139.
Not anything on 02739?
Just the paperwork, if my memory serves.
Okay.
In which we request, you know, an injunction, giving us final approval of the ANDA.
Is that okay, at least for the moment?
Mm-hmm.
At least for the moment? Okay, thank you, Mr. Moore. We'll save your rebuttal time. Now you've divided up the argument, Mr. Troy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. I'm here on behalf of the government appellees. I agree with Mr. Bruce to divide our time 2/3, 1/3. I know that we've only got about 25 minutes, so I don't want to do too much. With all due respect, the threshold jurisdiction question here is the one you got the end, which is jurisdiction. And I think that the whole sort of tenor of the discussion before the discussion of jurisdiction really illustrates the degree to which, again, with all due respect to this court, that right now this case does not belong in this court, because what we're talking about is construction of the statute, essentially an Administrative Procedure Act case.
Let me ask... I'm sorry. We let you get one sentence out. But if I could just ask one quick question, I think I know where you're going, and maybe I can short-circuit this.
Okay.
Suppose that we say, okay, no jurisdiction. The only question is here has to do with an APA challenge to the FDA's declining to take particular procedural steps, i.e. look at the patent for its merits. That goes to the D.C. Circuit. They say you're wrong. FDA has to look at these things. Now, does the next case come to us, or does the next case still go to the D.C. Circuit? Once it has been decided, let's suppose, make it easy, the Supreme Court affirms the D.C. Circuit. Henceforth, the question is whether the FDA, which is dutifully going through these reviews, the question then is, when a review of the FDA's decision, either to kick a case off the Orange Book or to keep it on, kick a patent off or keep it on, when that comes up under APA review, does that go to the D.C. Circuit or to us?
That would come. It is obviously that question's not here, but it might well come here, and let me explain why. That case would still arise under the APA, and that is the first problem of your jurisdiction. This court knows more about its jurisdiction than I do, but arising under, and whether patent was a necessary element of one of appetites.
Well, if that case would arise under our statute, then the decision as to whether that case exists must arise under our statute.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I'm just going to make the point that it still would not arise under the APA.
But it doesn't arise under the APA, it arises under the patent statute.
But no, it arises. I mean, the issue that we're discussing here is the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and the interpretation of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And it would arise under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and I don't believe this court wants to take jurisdiction over all appeals related to the Food, Drug,
the other half says, or requires decision of, depends on decision of.
Yes,
so you don't really have to decide in that case whether it arises under.
Right. Yes. So that we're on the second prong of your jurisdiction, which is, nor is a patent law determination a necessary element of one of Apotex's claims.
Yeah.
And at this point, what is before this court is the question that I guess Judge Plager thinks I should have started, which is whether or not FDA is properly decides not to undertake a substantive review of patents when they're listed in the Orange Book. That is the question before the court right now. It is an Administrative Procedure Act question that does not turn on of any kind of element of patent law. This is a straight Chevron B question of statutory interpretation. The gravamen of our argument here is that the statute says, C2 says, upon submission of the patent information, the secretary shall publish. That's on page 4A of the statutory appendix. FDA is given virtually no time to evaluate the patent information submitted. The Orange Book is meant to be updated every 30 days, which means if the patent comes in a few days before we have to update the Orange Book, we've got to list that. Again, upon submission, Secretary shall publish, we have 30 days to update the Orange Book, which could mean much less time to list. That certainly does not give time for the kind of administrative administrative mechanism that Judge Plager properly identified as the kind of thing that we would have to undertake if we were to undertake the analysis that Mr. Moore would like us to undertake.
Well, let me challenge you on that a little bit, because you're suggesting that what you would have to do is a full-scale patent analysis as to whether you'd have to do a Markman hearing, I suppose, on claim construction, and then you'd have to determine whether there was infringement literally or under the doctrine of equivalence, and then you'd have to go through all the defenses. And I suggest to you, I don't think that's at all true, because the statutory criteria for listing isn't whether there is, in fact, an infringement of the claimed patent. The statutory criteria for listing is that the patent claim the drug for which the applicant submitted the application. I'll leave out the subclause on method because it's the same thing. And that's one thing. A fairly straightforward call in many cases, although it could be complicated in a few, and with respect to which a claim of patent infringement could reasonably be asserted. That's a pretty low standard. That's not a full-blown patent litigation. I mean, we're familiar with the details of the full-blown patent world, and we wouldn't wish that on anybody. And I've always felt sympathy for the district courts. But that's not what this statute asks you to do. This statute asks you to do a much more limited analysis. So I'm not sure I'm willing to accept your proposition that you need to hire Lord Bissell and all the rest of those folks to come over and be FDA employees in order to make this thing work.
They'd volunteer.
Well, let me read you what Lord Bissell said, Your Honor. Page 32 of their brief, they wrote, "The analysis for determining the legality of Orange Book listing is identical to the analysis used in any patent infringement case, except once the claims of the relevant patent are properly construed, they are applied to the product that is the subject of the approved NDA rather than to an alleged infringer's
product." You're not suggesting should accept everything that Lord Bissell said, are you?
Not everything, but I think that is a major concession on their part.
Well, maybe a major concession on their part, but it's an erroneous assumption about what the statute requires. So let's deal with what the statute seems to call for. What's the problem?
The problem is that Congress seems to have, and we believe Congress unambiguously, took these kinds of inquiries and directed them to the courts where patent expertise resides. Hatch-Waxman is a complex signal.
But I'm sorry to say, we've just said in two cases the courts can't deal with it. Somebody has to deal with it, don't they?
At least with respect to the 30 months. I mean, that's where the rubber hits the road
that
here,
is,
let's face it. What we're really talking about is this mandatory, can't get out of it sort of 30 months, which we've managed to say in two different cases, go over there. And this, now we've arrived over there, and the question is, are we now to say, once you've arrived at the only remaining spot, you have no remedy?
There's no spot there.
Well, with respect, I think that there is a spot there, and that is that delisting can be a remedy in the district court from the infringement court. The infringement court can, under the Abbott case, order delisting at the end of the day. The whole
at the end of the day, but that, as a practical matter, the end of that day is after potentially a long string of 30-month stays, at least if the appellees are correct on the multiple 30-month stay issue, which stretch out as far as the eye can see, or the imagination of the patent drafters can permit, right? I mean, there's nothing the district court can do about that if we are right about Andrix.
That's
right?
Yes. The
right.
Choice that Congress made was to have these issues resolved in patent litigation in the courts, and part of the
which issues? Which issues resolved, counsel?
I would suggest all of the issues relating to the vindication of the intellectual property rights of the innovator v. vis-a-vis the generic.
Does that include the criteria for listing? I mean, that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
Look, there's a statute here that has two criteria in it for listing. The implication of listing is that there is going to be an automatic 30-month temporary injunction, whether you like it or not, and we've even told the district courts you can't do a lot about it in one of our cases, all right?
Now,
that listing concept has a tremendous impact, particularly when you have a clever innovator such as this one who likes to string listings on for ad infinitum. Now, you've got a problem. Can you help me? I've got a delegation problem with the denial by the agency of any willingness to look at its responsibility under this statute. Here's my delegation problem. As a general rule, Congress cannot delegate legislative power to an executive branch agency. You would agree with that.
Absolutely.
And there is a principle, a standard, that the Supreme Courts have said exists. Do you happen to remember offhand what the phrase is?
There's a...
You're close.
It's the panel.
An intelligible
principle.
Right. Congress set out an intelligible principle with two criteria in it, and that probably is sufficient for a delegation of power to the agency to make that determination. As I read the evidence in this case, the agency has sub-delegated that responsibility to the private sector. And what the agency says is, if there's a challenge to the listing, we, the agency, will call up and say, hey guys, did you really mean this listing? And if the guys say, oh yeah, that's the end of the case. I believe that's the ministerial concept
that
you're bringing us.
That is correct.
Now, I'm having a little problem with the principle of delegation involved here. And in fact, I've gone to the trouble of even looking at some of the cases on delegation and sub-delegation. And I think they put you at risk here because you have a statute which has significant legal impact on private sector parties, but nobody's policing it except the company that has a conflict of interest with regard to whether that listing is or is not valid. Help me understand how we're to sort of sweep that into the delegation doctrine.
Well, the delegation presupposes that we have an obligation to police again.
Somebody has to.
Well,
who is going to police? Look, you would agree that we have an intelligible principle or the whole thing goes out. We have to hold Hatch-Waxman unconstitutional as an improper delegation. I don't want to do that. So if we assume Hatch-Waxman is a valid delegation to the agency, what I have to understand from you is how does the agency implement its responsibilities under this delegation?
Again, I think we use those consistent with the choices that Congress made. Congress sets up this up as a complex signaling mechanism between the innovators and the generics, with listings as a means actually to speed generics to market and to give the generics a sense of what the full patent portfolio was that they would face on the part of the innovators. At the same time, the innovators got the right to confiscate, to be able to vindicate those patent rights in court. And Congress clearly has made the choice. The decision as to listing, if you will, more importantly, the vindication of the intellectual property rights are to be made where the expertise resides in the courts.
No question. What we're talking about is the 30-month temporary injunction trigger. That's all we're talking about.
Exactly. But Your Honor, what's being attempted here is, I think, an end run around the 30-month trigger, because Congress basically said, we're going to send these things to the courts and let the courts work them out. In the interim, we're going to put in this 30-month stay. Now, we certainly take your point at the FDA that there have been some problems. We should not overstate the problems. Courts like...
All we need is one problem, and we're up here.
That's correct. And so we tend to see the problems. But overall, Waxman is working pretty well. The number of cases where there have been these evergreen and multiple 39 stays is not that large. We do not denigrate them, and as you know, we propose a rule to try and get rid of multiple 39 stays.
99,999 people don't commit crimes.
Right.
It's that 0.1% that clog up the courts. We got that one problem right here, counsel. Deal with it.
The question is, first of all, whether Congress made the choice to give us, given that we have to list the patents again within less than 30 days, okay, to have us do that, and to a certain extent, whether, if you will, the game were handled, because to set up the kind of administrative structure that you were talking about would divert us from our other public health mission, our primary public health mission, including ANDA.
I understand all that, but we have a legal problem, not
yes.
a practical problem. The legal problem is, can you turn your back on your statute? I understand that you don't want to have to be bothered with all of this, and I don't blame you. I truly don't. But I don't know that that helps. Could we decide the law requires that somebody look at this, somebody who is within the ambit of proper delegation, but since the agency really doesn't want to be bothered, and it's a lot of hassle, we're not going to impose the delegation doctrine. Can we do that?
I wouldn't put it that way, Your Honor, obviously.
But that's
because
your argument.
I don't think I'm walking away from the statute. I think I'm relying on Congress' words, on the text of the statute, which says, upon a submission of the information, the Secretary shall publish. That's 355C2. D1 also says, upon approval, we shall publish, and we are obligated by the statute to update the Orange Book every 30 days. That strongly implies it's not actually decided, a purely ministerial function.
If I understand your argument, it really is, your response to Judge Plager, I take it on delegation, is really, this isn't a delegation problem because Congress didn't set up something that was to be decided. It simply said, as soon as you submit something that has the following things on the piece of paper, the FDA is to publish it. And they didn't anticipate that there was no decision-making to be done, at least in the course of the administrative process. So, ergo, no delegation.
Absolutely. In part,
no act. No, therefore, no act was delegated.
That is there's no mechanism for appeal. There's no delisting remedy. There's nothing in the statute that suggests that we are to undertake that and do anything other than the ministerial conduit by which the two parties are communicating.
But then the question is that comes that you may be right about that. And indeed, each of these various cases that we have decided, we've seen various parts of this animal bit by bit, may be defensible. But is it fair to assume that Congress intended to create a mechanism that would operate as we now, if we rule in your favor on this issue and sort of close the last door to review here of the 30-month stay issue? Is it fair to assume that Congress would have created such an animal?
I think it is fair to assume that Congress did not intend for the FDA to get into the business of claim construction and marketing.
Right, now that's the answer to this particular case. But then the broader question, I mean, you're here representing the public interest. And is it in the public interest to have a system that does not permit any review of a chain of 30-month stays? I mean, this may be an invitation for you to talk about the new regulations.
Well, exactly,
but
we have recognized the problem, and in the proper mode of administrative law, prospectively, context of rulemaking, and transparently, we propose to try and solve the problems that there are with Hatch-Waxman.
Now, let me overstate,
we have tried to deal with the problem in the proper way, but to impose upon us, contrary to the statute, this obligation to engage in claim construction at this point would, I don't think, end up speeding things because, as you said, Your Honor, we would have to make a decision, and then it would be challenged, and then it would come back to this court, and I'm not sure we would bring generic drugs to market anywhere.
Are you suggesting that the solution to this problem would be for us to hold that your proposed regulations, in fact, have been the law all along?
Absolutely.
That
not.
There were no sequential 30-month periods allowed, and therefore we adopt your position.
I believe that the reason why we didn't propose that is because we thought if we had, we would be in violation of laws of cases like Georgetown versus Bowen, which suggests that agencies may not act retroactively.
But we can act retroactively.
You can act retroactively, although you would have to invalidate a pre-existing legal regime embodied in regulation based upon a reasonable construction of the statute. And
unless, of course, we found the statute to be plain on its face, and that's Chevron step
yes,
one.
Yes, if you found under Chevron step one that our interpretation that there could be multiple 30-month stays was inconsistent because Congress had directly spoken to the precise question at issue. If you found that, then, of course, we would be in the world where our new regulation proposes us to be, but there would not be a reasonable transition period from one legal landscape where it would be usable to the new legal landscape where it would be usable. And again, under principles of administrative law, like Georgetown, we thought the only way that we could accomplish that would be prospectively, transparently, and formally.
I don't want to prolong this, but I just wonder whether I've misunderstood. I always thought the purpose of Hatch-Waxman was not to add an automatic 30 months to the life of a patent, but to permit a generic manufacturer to challenge the validity of the patent long before the patent had expired. So that is at any time, which of course can be done by just going out with an infringing product. But instead of doing that with all of the risks, to create this artificial infringement by statute, which then permits the litigation, and then the 30 months is the maximum period that one's allowed to drag out the litigation. So if that is, I guess, the purpose and the intent and the working of Hatch-Waxman. So can't a would-be competitor, a generic manufacturer, avoid a generic manufacturer to challenge the validity of the patent long before the patent had expired, so that is at any time, which of course can be done by just going out with an infringing product, but instead of doing that with all of the risks, to create this artificial infringement by statute, which then permits the litigation, and then the 30 months is the maximum period that one's allowed to drag out the litigation. So if that is, I guess, the purpose and the intent and the working of Hatch-Waxman, so can't a would-be competitor, a generic manufacturer, avoid the entire operation just by going out and with the infringing product and let the course of litigation occur without the benefits of the artificial infringement that Hatch-Waxman creates?
Well, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because what Hatch-Waxman does is it says to the FDA...
It has to be approved, is that it? That the ANDA has to be approved.
And it can't be approved until these issues are resolved.
They could go out, but then they'd go to jail because they have violated the FDA Act.
Yes.
But is the FDA then is prohibited from approving an ANDA during the course of this litigation?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Whether or not the patent is expired.
If the patent is expired, then presumably a patent holder, the ANDA holder says, it's a section, paragraph 3.
No, there wouldn't be.
And then it doesn't apply. Paragraph 4 only applies, the 30-month stay only kicks in, not with a paragraph 3, but a paragraph 4,
right,
which is an infringement or a claim of invalidity.
So if the patent expires in the middle of that.
Game over, and we approve the drug.
Okay.
You're right, Your Honor, that Hatch-Waxman was a complicated deal where the generics got certain things and the innovators got certain things. They got extensions of their exclusivity. The generics got the right to free ride on studies that were done by the innovators. But the mechanism for the vindication of the intellectual property rights was the 30-month stay. And it was meant to be decided, these issues were meant to be decided by the courts, by the infringement court, which has, we believe, the full panoply of remedies, including ordering the innovator to delist in the appropriate case at the end of the patent infringement litigation. That's the way the system was set up by Congress, and they did not intend for us to get into the business that, frankly, this court is much better suited to be doing. Your Okay,
can we let Mr. Troy off the hook?
No, I don't want to let Mr. Troy off the hook, but I don't have any more questions.
I do have one further question. I think you've answered it, but it'll just take 2 seconds, and that is that the new proposed regulations do not affect, I take it in any respect, the position you've argued to us in the 30-month stay portion of your brief.
No, correct? They do not.
They don't. Okay, that's what I thought you'd say. Fine.
Okay. Let's give Mr. Bruce his full 5 minutes.
I calculated 8, Your Honor, but I'll take whatever you can give. I appreciate it very much.
Time's up.
I'd like to start with an observation that you made, or a question that you had, Judge Plager. You said that's the end of the case at FDA when you go through this process and the pioneer drug reaffirms. The listing. Well, actually, it's not the end of the case. It wasn't the end of the case here. As it was required to do by the FDA's regulations, specifically 10.45B, 21 CFR, Apotex filed a citizen's petition. That's a requirement under those regs to seek judicial review, ultimately, of what the agency has done. And in the answer that the agency gave to the citizen's petition, it addressed the merits of the only argument that was put before it with respect to whether or not it was proper to claim a different polymer form of the active ingredient. I don't want to get into the details here because I don't understand the technology very well, but the agency was crystal clear on this point in its decision. This is on page 1559 of the record. That these anhydrate patents, which were slightly different than the hemianhydrate patents, the listing of them complies with the statute and FDA regulations. That was the decision, really, that's brought up here. And by the way, they did not raise in the citizen's petition then or later the other arguments that they're advancing now with respect to compression patents, product by process patents. They raised that question. We decided against them. Their burden is to show that the agency was arbitrary and capricious on the one question that they properly preserved. So they have the finality that Mr. Moore concedes under 704 they must have. They cannot show that decision was arbitrary and capricious. They haven't even mentioned it today in their argument. Among the reasons they can't show that is that there are two courts, the Zenith decision and the Venue decision, both discussed in the briefs, that reach the same conclusion, that when you claim a different polymer form of an active ingredient, it's listable. And while Andrix, that Judge Bryson was on, didn't decide that question, in footnote 5 of the decision, you acknowledge. Court acknowledged those district court decisions without suggesting in any way they were wrong. So that's an important thing to understand.
Did we suggest they were right?
Well, I read it that way, but Judge Bryson and
Judge Dyke wrote the opinion, and I won't speak for him.
In any event, that's important. Another thing important about the alternative hearing of state issue. We talked about Chevron, and that's what dominates the legal landscape today, but there are other principles out there that are important, that remain vital principles of statutory construction. And one of them is, under Udall versus Tallman, a decision from the 80s, the contemporaneous construction of the statute by the people, he said men then, but the people charged with responsibility for setting its machinery in motion and making the parts work efficiently and smoothly is entitled to particular deference. As the agency made clear in the notice of proposed rulemaking that you referred to, Judge Bryson, they have always interpreted Hatch-Waxman until this suggested change, which they say is a different reading of ambiguous language. They have always heretofore.
Do you disagree with their position that they could go from sequential 30-month to one?
In fact, we have not challenged that. There has been notice and comment on that rule, of course. It has not been challenged either by my client or by Pharma General.
When you say it hasn't been challenged, in court.
What I'm saying, in the
comments, no one has.
In the comments.
Has the comment period closed?
Well, we have filed our comments.
All right, but you have no objection to that?
That is correct. As a prospective matter, as it must be, because what they're doing is changing a legislative rule. They're changing 314.107b4, which very clearly contemplates multiple certifications with different expiration dates. When you change a legislative rule, you can only do it prospectively.
So you haven't challenged their proposed rulemaking to go to one 30-month rule?
That's correct.
Is that right? Well, all right. Then that raises, in my mind, the question, do you think Congress anticipated or foresaw the possibility that innovators would try to string together multiple 30-month periods by filing multiple variations on the basic patent for an extended period of time? Do you think Congress saw that and decided that that was okay? Or do you think Congress never even looked at the problem? The government takes the position that either the one 30-month or multiple 30 months are within the contemplation or the non-contemplation of Congress. Do you agree that that's so?
Well, that's the government's reading of the statutory language.
Yeah, I'm asking,
and
what is yours?
What is my view?
Yeah.
Speaking for my client.
Mm-hmm.
My view, at least, is, which is not informed by being present at the creation of Hatch-Waxman, and I'm new to this, is that Congress didn't think about that issue at all. It didn't address it one way or the other, which is an absolutely a textbook case for deference to the agency, especially in a now necessarily under the Mead case decided in 2001, when the agency then defines, if you will, the meaning of the statute through a legislative regulation. If there was anything in the legislative history of Hatch-Waxman or anything else that supported the argument that Apotex has advanced here about only one one 30-month stay, you would have heard of it. There is. Congress was silent. It's a gap. The agency is entitled to fill that gap. And again, it's important that they did it immediately. It's also important that, to my knowledge, which is not complete, but to my knowledge, until this argument advanced by Apotex in this case, no one had even advanced the theory of the statutory construction they had. And by the way, that's not the one the agency has adopted in its proposed rule. They have rejected Apotex.
Their theory, I guess, gets them to the same place, but it's a different theory.
One final word. We have consistently taken the position in this case that these issues of what court do you go to should be in the infringement court. There are obvious policy reasons for that. First, it recognizes that Hatch-Waxman protects the pioneer drug manufacturer's choice of form. 45-day moratorium ensures that. Secondly, the judge there knows what the patents are all about. This judge is adjudicating right now the validity of those patents. Third, he has or she has the authority to issue orders that bind all parties, unlike the situation where we have here, where Apotex goes off by itself to litigate in the D.C. Circuit, and then the others are free to ignore that judgment when Apotex loses. And finally, and this might be important, if those matters are adjudicated in that court, this court unquestionably has jurisdiction. There's no doubt about that. Now, to be sure,
I understand what you're saying. You're saying that we should take jurisdiction over this whole mess.
No. What I'm saying is, when these issues of listing are decided by the patent infringement court in the course of a patent case, you clearly have jurisdiction over them. Now, Mylan, of course, Mylan.
Why would a patent litigation court ever decide the listing issue?
Well, there's an answer to that in two cases that I'll bring to your attention. One is Abbott Laboratories versus Zenith, 934 FedSup 925. A more recent one decided just this last month, KOS versus Barr Laboratories, 2003 Westlaw, 145578. Both cases held that listing questions could be questions of defense of a 271E2 infringement claim. Now, Mylan said otherwise. My, let me finish. Mylan said otherwise in this context, and the same context was true in Hendricks. In those cases, the generic went off by itself, you know, in a declaratory judgment action, which itself is infamous. Mylan said that these issues, what condemned an independent cause of action seeking to be listed outside the property of that case. It did say, without examining 271E2 at all, referring only to 282 and the plain, you know, general language of that section, that these listing issues weren't a defense. It's up to you to decide if there's a way out of this. I think it was you, Judge Bryson, asked where lies the public interest in all of this. The point is, my client has committed itself to recognizing that these kind of listing issues can be raised in Philadelphia. They have pled them. They have pled them as answers to infringement in the Philadelphia case. I'm just offering that as a final.
What would be the argument would be, it shouldn't, dear court, it shouldn't have been listed. I shouldn't have had to file a paragraph 4 certification, so you should throw the whole thing out. Is that the argument?
The argument, well, let me tell you.
And how does that differ from saying, the only way you could get there is by saying that patent doesn't have anything to do with the drug for which I've filed my ANDA. How is that any different from the basic patent litigation that's supposed to take place?
It's very different. What we're talking about here is the artificial, very special infringement that was created by Hatch-Waxman.
Yeah, but we've said the creation is artificial, but the litigable issues are traditional.
Well, all I'm saying is that there are two district courts out there, one of which held, for example, that a late listed patent.
I don't care what the district court said. I want you to help me understand why would challenging, I mean, I'm just curious, why would challenging the listing be any different from litigating the question of infringement?
Well, there's infringement under
patent validity.
There's infringement under 271A, of course, classic infringement, that would be available irrespective of all the listing. I'm talking about the special cause of action created under 271E2 that has to do with the interplay between that administrative process and patent law. The Supreme Court discussed the nature of that in the Lilly case, and this court has in other cases, including a recent one that you were on in Apotex, decided in January. All I'm saying is when you look at that special nature of that infringement action, it's at least open to thought, and two district courts have so held, that there might be room in that case for raising the listing issues. What I'm saying to you as well is that's been our constant position in this court. Their position in Philadelphia remains.
But all I'm asking is to what end would you...
To the end of giving that district judge the opportunity to say, no, you can't have this, you didn't have to certify to this patent because it was improperly listed, or you didn't have to certify because under their theory, which we reject on the merits, of course, you can't have more than 130-month stay. Put that in the hands of that court, let that court decide it. Then they come up as clear patent law questions, part of a major patent infringement case.
Thank you. Do you think we have jurisdiction over this case?
Do I think you do? My honest answer is no, I don't think you do.
So you agree with Mr. Troy?
That's my honest opinion.
And if the D.C. Circuit, to ask him, you the same question I asked him, if the D.C. Circuit were to decide this case, by holding that the FDA did have an obligation to review the patents, and there were an APA action for review of that decision in the next case, or even in the same case, would we then have jurisdiction
then
over that question?
Then you would have some substantial questions of patent law in the case.
And that would give us jurisdiction,
well,
in your view?
That's an alternative prong of your jurisdiction, as I understand it. Then you would, this case,
then we would have jurisdiction.
It's an odd concept that the exact same case goes to one court for a preliminary determination and then to another court after that preliminary determination is made by court number one.
The preliminary determination would be one that, once made, would be made for all cases at the agency.
Well, that's right, but presumably
it
sounds like what you're saying is that the D.C. Circuit could address the question of the obligation of the FDA to decide this issue, but couldn't go ahead and say anything about the merits.
And properly, it shouldn't.
Right.
I mean, properly, of course.
Okay.
As you know,
and we have jurisdiction to address the merits, but we wouldn't have jurisdiction to address the question of whether we have jurisdiction to address the merits.
No,
well, wasn't that decided?
No, that's not so. I was going to complete my answer to Judge Bryson. Under classic administrative law principles, if in fact the agency violated by not deciding things, as I indicated, they certainly did decide something in the citizen petition.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's so, then the classic remedy of the Administrative Procedure Act is to remand to the agency for a decision, not for the Court of Appeals itself.
All right, but for this case, the complaint is filed and the district court raised both issues. Did it not? It wasn't just a request for an order that the FDA do take the action, but wasn't the district court also asked to decide that the patent did not cover?
That's right. So that just puts the principle down at the district court rather than the Court of Appeals. If Judge Jackson had agreed with the arguments that Apotex advanced about what the FDA should and should not do, he should have sent it back to the agency to make those determinations. So that's what happened.
How about if there was an appeal from his decision?
Well,
he says, I'm going to send it back to the agency, and the government says, oh, no, you're not. We're appealing. Where would that appeal go?
That would then depend on whether a stay.
Where would that appeal go? He says, agency, you should have.
No, that goes to D.C. Circuit.
I think that'd have to be so, in your view and Mr. Troy's view. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think that's what the burden of the argument would be. That would go to the D.C. Circuit, and then if you lost there and it went back to the agency and there were determination on the merits, then it would come to us.
That's correct.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bruce.
Yes.
Mr. Moore?
I will try my hardest. Burden on the agency. The agency has, there is precedent out there of FDA's regulations and described it in our view. There is no reason.
Speak up, Mr. Moyer.
There really is no reason, absolutely, why FDA would have to read every patent submitted to it. FDA could operate on the presumption that parties listing are acting, submitting patent information are acting in good faith. List, when there's a challenge, deal with it then. What FDA does in administering its Freedom of Information Act regulations on classification of information's trade secret, third party comes in and challenges that. FDA's regulation invites the submitting party to come in and intervene. And if the submitting party does not come in to intervene to establish the true trade secret character of this information, FDA reserves the right to produce it. FDA can be a stakeholder here and not spend another dollar.
Assuming, Mr. Moore, that the proposed FDA rule for non-sequential 30-month temporary injunction was in effect at the beginning of this hassle, would that have solved your problem?
A single 30-month stay?
Yeah.
Yes, it would. In fact, it's my belief that we would not be facing this litigation in Philadelphia. The case would never have been filed. These patents, if I may be permitted, are garbage. They are procured.
Well, I think they were granted by the Patent Office, so I think it's not before us to decide their merits on these accusations.
I apologize, Your Honor.
No, you're entitled to your First Amendment
views. I will say there is a gamut of patents from the very meritorious to the less meritorious, if that's fair. And I have my own judgment on where in that continuum these patents lie. Now, important question. Was there any legislative history indicating that Congress foresaw the multiple 30-month stay issue. And there is legislative history. And we quoted it in our briefs, in our brief. And here, the committee report says, our preface was, when Congress enacted Hatch-Waxman, it had been assured by both the patent office and the private patent bar that, I'll pick up a quote, so-called evergreening is not a problem. No credible information was submitted to the subcommittee showing that drug firms obtained a chain of patents related to the same product for the purpose of prolonging their patent. Now, one of the issues I haven't had an opportunity to discuss is whether it is legal to list patents that do not claim the drug as originally approved. We've submitted that argument in our brief. These questions interlock. Much of the problem that we have today arises from the fact that Congress contemplated, if you read statute carefully, Congress contemplated, I think quite clearly, in legislating within the context of patent, substantive patent law, that patents would be applied for and likely issued sometime around the original review process.
But what I don't, if the patent doesn't claim the drug, then why should that present any problem to a person who wishes to produce a generic version of that drug?
My example is this case. The active ingredient in SmithKline's Paxlovid.
Well, the answer is because it triggers the 30-month delay.
Is
the short answer?
Well,
but then that's because you've taken the position that it does cover the drug and invoked the certification.
I'm sorry,
that
I
it does.
Interrupt your answer.
If I understand the question you're in for, Your Honor, let me back up and say the acting ingredient in SmithKline's Paxlovid is crystalline peroxide hydrochloride and hydrate. These patents that we're talking about today involve anhydrate. Three of them involve anhydrate forms. There's a difference in water hydration between the semi-hydrate and the anhydrate.
That's why I don't understand why you would raise a Section 4 certification against a patent that doesn't cover the product for which you've filed the ANDA.
We have paragraph 4 certifications stating non-infringement of these anhydrate polymorph patents. But that is fundamentally and essentially irrelevant to, I submit, to the question before the court today, whether these anhydrate polymorph patents claim the hemihydrate, which is the active ingredient covered by SmithKline's approved new drug application. An entirely different question. I submit the claim construction question there is quite easy. Now,
I think that Newman is asking, why did you even file paragraph 4s against those patents if those patents didn't cover the claim of the original NDA?
We have no discretion in that respect. FDA has made the judgment in the regulation that we are attacking that it will
not
resolve.
If it's listed, you have to file.
Listing disputes, we must file a certification.
Because you have, because your ANDA is based on identity of product, is that right?
No, Your Honor, it is not. Let me get to the same drug.
I've taken us pretty far afield, and I don't want to lead
well,
you.
Well, no, this is a good. I think this is a profitable. I'd like to hear the answer.
I think we're getting into another different area. 355J, which is the provision statute, and J2, in particular, assess for what one must conclude in an abbreviated new drug application. There is a subparagraph that says that you must supply information show that the active ingredient covered by your abbreviated new drug application is, quote, the same as, the active ingredient in the approved new drug that you are referencing. Now here, and Smith Klein did not mention it, the issue has been decided by the D.C. Circuit in a case of the name of Serono Laboratories, quoted or cited. What the court held in Serono was that FDA, in administering the provisions of 505J regarding ANDAs, had or and has discretion to approve an abbreviated new drug application whose active ingredient has a different chemical structure than the chemical structure of the active ingredient in the innovator's drug, provided that there is no evidence that the structural difference affects the safety and efficacy of the drug.
I don't think
they meant...
In other
words, it's irrelevant for clinical purposes. FDA can approve. FDA does it all the time.
Different chemical structure?
That's correct.
It's not formulation or actually a different chemical?
A different chemical. Now, what we have here, from a chemical standpoint, is we have a...
But you have to have bioequivalence.
That's right. They have to be bioequivalent. And that's the touchstone for approval of an ANDA. And we have to go out and affirmatively demonstrate the bioequivalence.
Let me come back just very briefly to Judge Newman's question, which maybe there's a simple answer to this, but I'm missing it if there is. Your contention is that these patents that were listed do not claim the listed drug.
Correct.
Right. The obligation in paragraph 7 of J2A... 7 is the obligation to certify with respect to each patent which claims the listed drug, either certification 1, 2, 3, or 4. 4 is the one at issue here. And the question is, why don't you say we don't have to file 4? It's not claiming the listed drug. Is it your position that FDA prohibits you from making that independent judgment?
That's correct.
And what's the regulatory mechanism by which they do prevent you from making that independent judgment?
FDA's regulation in which it refuses to police...
Well, no, it's not the refusing to police. It's really a separate legal question. Why is it not the case that you could simply say the patents don't claim the listed drug? That's our judgment. We're the ones that have to file this certification. We're not filing the certification because we've made this independent judgment.
We have no room for that under FDA's regulations.
What would be the consequence of your refusing to file? This is really the question. If you refuse to file a paragraph 4 certification with regard to any of 12 patents that's listed under Paxil, what would be the consequences in terms of your ANDA?
The regulatory consequence would be a refusal to grant final approval of our ANDA for failure to file certifications.
In other words, FDA takes the position, if it's listed, you're not going to get an approved ANDA until you have certified every one of those patents that are listed.
Yes, sir.
So you don't have a choice of saying, but that one's not applicable. Is that right?
Yes, sir, Your Honor. That's correct.
It's a different question from the FDA review issue. At least it seems to me.
You're saying you're going to be forced to litigate 12 to use the number of patents that you're not in any sense infringing in order to get your application approved?
Ultimately, yes.
If
the innovator chooses to file a lawsuit.
Right.
Well, but you initiate the lawsuit with your paragraph 4 certification. You're saying you're forced to initiate a lawsuit against patents that you know you're not infringing?
We don't initiate the notice, Your Honor. Under the regulatory scheme, we provide...
You don't initiate the lawsuit.
You initiate the notice. And they're then obliged to file suit or else forever give up.
No, Your Honor. They have a 45-day window in which to decide whether to grant a statutory patent infringement action under 271E.
Yeah.
If they don't, They can wait until after final approval and file a conventional patent infringement action if they believe there is infringement.
So let's be sure we've nailed this down. What you're saying is you have no choice if you want to get your ANDA issued. You have no choice but to file a paragraph 1, 2, 3, or 4 certification against any patent that's listed in the Orange Book that's relevant to the drug that you want your ANDA on. Is that right?
The drugs are all the patents are irrelevant in your sense, but we have no discretion. We must provide a certification or FDA will not grant us final approval.
And if they don't file an infringement suit, you say that they can say, no, I'm not going to file an infringement action. Let them go ahead, put their product on the market, and then I'll sue them?
That is their option.
It doesn't sound like the Hatch-Waxman that I remember, although I... Accepting that, then the generic manufacturer is deprived of the opportunity of challenging the patent, and whereas the patentee can wait until the generic manufacturer is in over his head and then file suit.
Your Honor, I think the best response I have to that is that there is nothing in the legislative history that indicates that this statutory patent infringement mechanism was intended to benefit the generic manufacturer.
I have to argue with you on that. It was deeply... rigorously negotiated relationship which provided a way for a generic manufacturer to challenge a patent without going to the risk of marketing an infringing product. I had thought that that was viewed as a significant benefit.
I can only tell you, Your Honor, what I recall from a careful reading of the legislative history as it stands today. I will tell you that there are differences of opinion in the generic industry over precisely your point. I will tell you that my client is prepared to go to market in advance of determination of infringement and validity in appropriate circumstances. And it will do so, it is told the FTC, it will do so in this case. Here's a cardinal difference. Here's a cardinal difference, and it gets us back to the 30-month step. That is a free preliminary injunction. Free.
For which the generic manufacturer obtained the right to use the patentee's data, clinical and other data, to the benefit of its own registration. And that I had understood at the time as an observer. Well, it was viewed as an enormous benefit, and I gather you don't disagree with that.
The latter is absolutely right. It was an enormous benefit, and that is a critical aspect of the legislative compromise. However, I come back to the proposition that this statute has to be read, and I will say it once. The statute ought to be read as an organic whole, all of its parts, all together. And it has to be read in light of the competing objectives. And it ought to be read, we submit, in light of case law from this court and the Supreme Court, which says, in a situation where statute represents a carefully negotiated compromise, it ought to be carefully construed to avoid upsetting the balance.
All right. Your colloquy with Judge Newman raised an issue I never even thought about because I never thought it was at issue. And that is, do I understand there is at least some question, that it's an open question? If a paragraph 4 certification is given, notice is given, if the Pioneer drug holder, patent holder, I should say, Pioneer patent holder declines to do anything. No action is taken. The ANDA is issued. Is there a question as to whether the pioneer could later sue the generic for infringement of that patent? I would have assumed that that issue is always available as long as the patent is valid, as long as the patent is not yet expired. But is there a question about that?
No. I think there's no question at all. The patentee in this situation surely retains his rights under 271A.
There wasn't my, maybe we should ask, could you send us a couple of pages of briefing on that point, each of you, as to the obligation of the patentee to respond, or you say there's no obligation to respond to a paragraph 4 certification with an infringement suit, and that the patentee loses, hasn't waived any opportunity to sue for infringement?
Yes, Your Honor. Well,
I think a couple of pages from each of you would be helpful. I certainly don't know the answer to that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe we should ask the other side also.
Yes, indeed.
Would they give us their view on that subject?
Within a week and a half or so, or yep. 10 days?
10 days.
And to try and keep it to just a couple of pages, unless it's even more complicated than... because this is something that I hadn't thought about.
It is a hideously complicated problem.
Which raises a question I have for you, Mr. Moore. Why shouldn't this whole matter be Congress's problem instead of ours?
That's what Judge Jackson said.
I think, Your Honor, from that standpoint, it took years of work for Congress to get to the result that it got to in 1984. Legislation has been introduced in, I think, last year, perhaps the year before, and it may be forever for any legislative body that's forthcoming. And it remains our view that if this statute is carefully construed, the fixes are there. And that's the reason we went to the district court, and that's the reason why we're here today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Moore, Mr. Troy, Mr. Bruce. Case is taken under submission.